Hi, everybody. It's Michael Bennett. I can't thank you enough for making time to join this call. It's been a really tough year for our state, from the pandemic to the economic crisis to a devastating season for wildfires and drought. So I hope you're all taking care of yourselves and your families during these difficult times. Before we begin, I want to introduce Dr. Rachel Herlihy, who's the Colorado epidemiologist with our Department of Public Health and Environment. She's joining the call. I'm very grateful for her time. She's incredibly busy. She's been doing an amazing job, but I think she's communicates on COVID so well, and it's very, very useful to have her today. And she'll be available to answer your questions about the state's response to COVID. Rachel and I are going to speak for a few minutes to kick this call off, but throughout the call, if you have a question, you can dial *3 on your phone. You can start doing that now. You don't need to wait for us to finish speaking. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, dial *3. I'll start by spending a few minutes laying out where I think we are with respect to the pandemic and the economy, and then I'll end with a minute on where I think we need to go from here. Then I'll turn it over to Rachel, and then we can take your questions. Right now, we're living through the worst phase of the pandemic in the country and in Colorado. In Colorado, we're averaging over about 4,000 cases a day. For perspective, that's over 8 times where we were at the start of May. Nationally, we've surpassed 15 million cases, and this week, we lost over 3,000 Americans to the virus in one day, the highest on record over the past 9 months. The trends all point in the wrong direction across the country. Dr. Hurley, he will tell you that in some respects in Colorado, we've seen some better news in recent days, but I'll let her tell you. The truth is, for the country, things are going to get worse before they get better. But it will get better. The vaccines are coming. Just yesterday, the FDA's advisory panel recommended emergency use of the Pfizer vaccine. That's good news. But it's still going to take many months before we can immunize everybody and let things return to normal. I've had calls now with the new administration's transition team on COVID, and anything that you're reading in the newspapers about political disputes and all those kinds of things, I just want you to know these folks are hard at work already, thinking about how to stand up a national approach to make sure that the vaccinations get out to people and that it happens in an orderly and expeditious way. And I think that we are going to look back and at some point and say this was really the worst of this, and that we were able to come out of it late in the spring. But that means that we've got several months ahead where we've got to keep doing everything we can to limit new infections and keep our hospitals from becoming overwhelmed. That's really the measure of how we're doing, is whether we're able to manage the hospital flow. And that means all of us need to wear masks, we need to social distance, and we need to limit in-person gatherings whenever possible. Going into the holiday, people are going to have to be really, really careful. And the next few months are also going to be really tough on the economy, not just on health and not just on mental health, unless we have more action from Washington. Back in March, Congress came together in a bipartisan way to pass the CARES Act. It was not a perfect bill, but it kept 12 million people in this country from slipping into poverty. It kept food on the table for millions of people, thousands of people in Colorado, and saved a lot of small businesses from extinction. But that bill was only meant to serve as a bridge through July, when we hoped to have a better handle on the virus. That obviously didn't happen. And instead of coming together to pass a package, some people in Washington took a wait-and-see approach. Well, 5 months later, the pandemic is worse than it's ever been, and I think that if we don't act, our workers and families and small businesses are in for a very, very hard winter. I hear from people all the time about how close people are to losing their business or the choices they're having to make to go without food or go without medicine or not pay the rent. And in Colorado, weekly unemployment claims are rising once again. They're now roughly 7 times higher than they were before the crisis began. Nationally, we're down, still down, more than 10 million jobs from February. Just to give you a clear sense of what that looks like, that's more jobs than we lost in the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009. And on top of that, we're also heading toward what people in Washington call a benefits cliff at the end of the year, when federal relief that's been so important to keep people in their homes and to keep food on the table, when federal relief for evictions and enhanced unemployment are all set to expire. And if that happens, Washington's going to throw 12 million people into a financial crisis all across America, including 122,000 people in Colorado. So I don't believe that we can fail at this. The Senate needs to pass a new relief package. It needs to go to the president for his signature. I'm pushing extremely hard to make sure that it includes four priorities that I've been fighting for since the summer. First, we need to surge our community health efforts for testing and contact tracing and public health support so we're in a position to get everybody vaccinated as soon as possible. I have a bill with Senator Gillibrand to do that by training hundreds of thousands of people for a new health force that would boost our public health capacity at the local level. A similar bill has passed the House of Representatives. Second, we need to help the hardest hit small businesses, keep them afloat until we're on the other side of the pandemic. The CARES Act attempted to do that with a program called PPP, but I think my Restart Act with Senator Young, a Republican from Indiana, could do an even better job. That bill now has 59 co-sponsors, by all half Democrats, half Republicans in the Senate, and it's the first bill I've ever had that was endorsed by both Lady Gaga and by Clint Eastwood. So maybe that's enough for Mitch McConnell. We'll see. Third, we have to extend the enhanced unemployment benefits so families have a lifeline until the economy recovers. I proposed a number of bills to do that, and I think there's renewed understanding on the part of both parties that this is something we need to do. If you had to ask me what my number one priority is, that would be my number one priority. Finally, state and local governments are going to hemorrhage jobs if we don't provide them with some relief to fill the massive holes in their budgets created by the pandemic. I'm grateful about what Governor Polis and the state legislature did over the past couple weeks to provide Coloradans with emergency relief. Coloradans are going to need all the help they can get, but it's not going to be enough without federal support. Washington needs to act. We have to create a bridge for the country to keep our heads above water until we get to the other side of the pandemic. And I think if we come together in a bipartisan way to do what we need to do, like we did back in March, I'm confident that we will. In the Senate, I'm encouraged by the growing momentum around a bipartisan proposal for about a $900 billion package. It doesn't go as far as I'd like in many ways, but I think it's the right basis for an agreement. If we put it on the Senate floor next week, I think it would pass overwhelmingly because people on both sides appreciate the urgency of the situation. They know there's no way that we should leave for the holidays without doing our job for the country in this moment of crisis. So I want to thank all of you for being on this call. I want to thank you for the questions that you'll ask, for the criticisms and thoughts that you're going to give, and I want to say again how much I hope everybody is taking care of themselves, for themselves and for their family, but also for our state and for the country. So I'm going to stop there, let Dr. Hurley say a few words, and after that we're happy to take any questions anybody has on any topic. Remember, if you have a question, please dial *3 on your phone. Rachel?
Great. Thank you so much, Senator, and thank you. I'm so grateful for your leadership in D.C. and your support to Coloradans at this time. Obviously, I come at this pandemic as an epidemiologist, and my focus is really infectious disease control. But, you know, as a public health physician, I clearly recognize that an economic issue for this state is also a public health issue, and that we need to really tackle this pandemic from multiple sides. I also want to thank Coloradans for all of their actions and sacrifices to bend the curve and decrease transmission in the state. This is obviously a really difficult time, and the things that we are asking you to do from a public health perspective at this already difficult time, we recognize is a significant sacrifice and is, you know, an additional challenge for your family. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and And I worry so much about her right now and the impact of this pandemic on her and her education. I also have a dad who's in his 70s. He lives alone, and I worry quite a bit about him right now. And I know that many of you and your families are facing the same challenge and same worries. But as the senator said, we know that there is light at the end of the tunnel. We have a vaccine on the horizon. We're hoping that vaccine could arrive in Colorado as soon as next week. We know it's going to still be several months, and we know that the next couple of months are going to be incredibly difficult. We know that, you know, while the vaccine is coming, it's still going to be several months before we have a clear impact of the vaccine contributing to herd immunity and decreasing disease transmission in the state. It's probably not until the late spring that we're really going to see the clear impact of the vaccine for the amount of disease transmission that's occurring right now. As the senator mentioned, we are seeing really high rates of disease transmission in Colorado right now and across the country. But we have seen a little bit of good news in Colorado in the last couple of days. We've seen that our rates have stabilized. So compared to before Thanksgiving, where we were seeing really this exponential growth, this rapid increase in the number of cases in the state, in the last week or two, and specifically in the last couple of days, we've seen a stabilization and now even a slight decrease in the number of cases that have occurred. Right now, we think we're just beginning to see the initial potential impact of individuals who may have been exposed over Thanksgiving. And so far, we are not seeing a significant increase in transmission following the Thanksgiving holiday. And I think that is really because of all of the many things that Coloradans did leading up to the holiday and during the holiday to decrease the risk of transmission. So wearing masks, social distancing, making those personal sacrifices to gather with just individuals in your own household, all of those things seem to be making a difference in that we are seeing a stabilization in rates of disease right now. And we are not necessarily seeing that across the country right now. So I think that this is good news for Colorado, and I think Coloradans should feel good about the sacrifices that they've made and the impact that those sacrifices have had to disease transmission. These actions are literally saving lives in the state, and we know that that's obviously an incredibly important goal here when we look at flattening the curve, is to save Coloradans' lives. But as the senator said, we know that it's still going to be several months of a difficult time. We need these actions to stay in place. We need to, again, as we start looking to the winter holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's, that we need to really keep up the actions that we've had in place and stay the course with where we are right now. We're in a better place, but it would really only take, you know, some slight changes in social distancing and other parameters for us to potentially be back where we were just 3 weeks ago with rapid increase in cases once again. So thank you to all of you for your actions, and I look forward to your questions and talking more about COVID-19 and the state's response.
You know, Rachel, I'm going to ask you the first question, if that's okay.
Sure, of course.
One thing I just want to mention to everybody is every day I get a report on where we are in COVID, and it starts with charts that show what the daily case increase was, what the hospitalizations are, and then, as Rachel said, what the deaths are, because these trends are all predictable based on what the curves are doing. So when you see, you know, more people getting cases, that's a predictor that later you're going to see more deaths. That's why it's so important to see the number of cases going down, because what that tells us is that in the next, you know, period of time, the curve on deaths will begin to turn down as well. So it does make an incredible difference, and I'm proud of Colorado for doing as well as we did during Thanksgiving, and I hope we'll do it again in this holiday season. You mentioned herd immunity, and I just wonder whether you might describe a little bit, now that we're moving into this period of vaccinations, how the vaccinations are related to herd immunity, how that all kind of works together, and what the next 3 or 4 or 5 months, however you want to think about it, are going to look like for people in terms of the rollout of vaccinations and hopefully getting to herd immunity.
Sure. So first of all, I want to say that there's still quite a bit we need to learn about this virus. We know from our knowledge of other coronaviruses and from some initial, you know, experiences we're having with this virus, that with coronaviruses, and it looks like this virus as well, we can see reinfection occur. And so we don't know specifically how long immunity will last. And so it's quite possible that, you know, herd immunity that we experience might be shorter term. But I think we still really need to understand how short term it might be, what the duration of immunity is, you know, whether having a prior infection or a vaccine protects you for 3 months, 6 months, a year, the rest of your life. Really, I think those are all things that we're still trying to learn. But it's really that combination of individuals that may have immunity from experiencing the infection. And we think in Colorado, about 16.5% of our population have had the infection to date. Plus, you know, the efforts of vaccines to really try and create that level of immunity in the state that would prevent ongoing widespread transmission of this disease. There's still going to be sporadic cases that occur. When we talk about this term herd immunity, it's really, you know, the percentage of the population that needs to be immune to prevent ongoing widespread disease transmission.
Okay, thank you very much. Amy or Connor, I'm not sure who's running the show here, but do we have a first question?
We do. So Elizabeth Harris, who is watching the live stream, asked, what are you doing to help with the stimulus package? And Laura from Elizabeth has a similar question. Laura, you are now live. Please introduce yourself and go ahead and ask your question.
Laura?
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah. Yep.
Oh, okay. Thank you very kindly. I'm sorry. My question, I have a two-part question because I didn't know Dr. Herlihy would be on, and I'm a big fan. So my first question is for you, Senator Bennett. I appreciate all the work that you're doing to get something out to help us. And how willing are you all to stay in and kind of hash things out if this, because it feels like, you know, we've been here before. This is the third time we've gotten right up to the wire and everything tends to fall flat. So I have a lot of anxiety around that. And then for Dr. Hurley, I wanted to ask if you would be kind enough to let us know, like, so this will peak at some point in the United States as a whole. And we have a couple of things coming online that are hopeful. One is the weather is going to go back to being favorable because it just went through being unfavorable, so that will work in our favor. Obviously, the vaccines, obviously more people are kind of getting it. But we do still have the rogue faction out there who are kind of doing what they like, and that's going like that's going. So with all of those factors and all the millions of other ones that you look at that I would never consider, I wondered if you would pinpoint your most optimistic month for that change to come over and your least optimistic month for when that change might come over, where the entire United States starts to go down in numbers in a permanent way. Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. I appreciate your work, and that's my question.
Thank you very much, and I'll be very brief. I think we shouldn't leave until, you know, or we need to finish this work before the Senate recesses for the holidays. It's Friday. I'm usually in Colorado on Friday. Today we're actually here continuing to negotiate the COVID bill and also the budget and the National Defense Authorization Act. And I think what might happen today is that we end up with about a week-long, what's called a continuing resolution to kind of keep the lights on here and in order to allow us to keep negotiating. So please, I think that's a message everybody should be saying to their elected officials. Please get this done before you come home for the holidays. And Dr. Herlihy, let me turn over the other question to you.
Sure thing. So I do think that, you know, we can expect that January, February, potentially even March will continue to be challenging. But I do think as we move into the spring, things will start to look better. From the national estimates that I've seen from, you know, national and international modeling teams, the projections look like the vaccine could potentially start to have a clear impact around April. We know that it's going to be several months still. And that's also, as you mentioned, the time when things start to warm up a little bit, people move outdoors, we have less risk of disease transmission, we know, in outdoor environments versus indoor environments. So I do think that the spring will bring much better conditions, much more favorable conditions, and we'll probably begin to see less disease transmission in the spring because of a combination of factors, really the percentage of the population that's been infected, the percentage of the population that's been vaccinated, and then all of the things that happen in the spring and summer that really decrease contacts between individuals. You know, I think we have a lot more to learn, though, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, about reinfection and what that might mean for us, you know, as we move on several months after the spring into the fall and next winter. Is this going to look like the flu, where we see, you know, epidemics every winter season, or is it going to be different then? I think we still have a lot to learn.
What Rachel just said is exactly what I've heard from the Biden transition people. They're saying the same thing about when they think that skies are going to start to clear a little bit, and that's important for everybody to know, I think, because this is not last February. You know, we have a vaccine. We have, as Rachel said, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And for those of us that have folks that have really struggled with, you know, over the months, I think it's important to remind people that, you know, this isn't going to be another 12 months, and we've come a farther distance already than we have to travel to get to, you know, to get to a place where things are much brighter and more stable, and I think that's good news. All right, Connor.
Next, we have a question from Anthony from Broomfield. Anthony, you are now live. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Thank you, Connor, and also thank you, Senator Bennett, and your guests on this show. I've been a fan of this town hall process you've had for the past year, giving us a great deal of encouragement in Colorado, and I thank you for taking the initiative. My question is, we have been under the pressure of a narcissistic president for 4 years that has terribly impacted the functionality of the Senate. And specifically, we now have a Senate majority leader who refuses to identify a different path for the Republican Party. Do you see a way forward for the Senate to function between now and January 20th and after January 20th with President-elect Biden in office, that it can actually be a functioning body again?
Anthony, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that question. We need the Senate to be a functioning body again because, as my friend Lamar Alexander, who's a Republican from Tennessee, said in his farewell speech, this, for better or for worse, this is the institution in America that's designed to decide hard questions and make them stick. And in the last number of years, it has not acted that way because of the way Mitch McConnell has approached his job as majority leader. I want to be very precise about that. You asked the question so well. Is there a way to change it, you know, so that there's a different kind of Republican approach? Because McConnell, it's not about the fact that he's a Republican. It's just the way he thinks about his job. And he believes his job is to put the most conservative judges on the courts and every now and then cut taxes for the wealthiest people in America. And by the way, he's borrowing all that money from China. He's not paying for any of those tax cuts. For, you know, we've got an economy that the worst income inequality since 1928, and he's cutting taxes for the wealthiest people, making that inequality even worse. I don't think that's a Republican position. I think that's Mitch McConnell's position. And I don't think it's a Republican position to have the Senate be completely dysfunctional. I think that's the way Mitch McConnell has accrued power, and it's no different than the way people did it in Roman times until now. So I think the country desperately needs to have a functioning Senate, not for the senators, but for the country, to be able to resolve difficult issues that we have to face. And the fact that we can't take votes on important issues simply because of the way McConnell runs the place, you know, I think has to come to an end. So this is not the topic really of today's call, although I'm happy to take the question. I am working with some other senators to propose changes to the rules in January that would prioritize legislation that's come out of committees in a bipartisan way and say that kind of legislation with bipartisan support ought to get consideration on the floor, even if the majority leader says it shouldn't. It's going to be hard to overcome him. It's going to be difficult, and I don't want to give you false hope. But I think it's important to make the point that the Senate isn't working, and we need it to work better for the American people. Connor? I can tell you this, it would work a lot better if Rachel Herlihy were in the Senate, but she's got more important work to do.
Our next question is from Dee from Salida. Dee, you are now live. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Dee from Salida.
Yes, Salida, not Salida. the weapon assists at Salida. So I understand that we're making progress, but I don't think we can have an economic recovery until we really make some serious progress on nailing this virus. It is taking out 3,000 people a day. That is between 9 and 12,000 people at the current rate between now and March. Why can't we do something to motivate law enforcement to help enforce the mask mandate? In Salida, it is a tourist town. Tons of people are coming in from out of state, out of town. I see people gathering in large groups in their homes without masks. Stores are becoming very dangerous. There is a lot of anger and resentment when people are told or asked to do the right thing. Doing the right thing is not working. Other states are giving tickets. Couldn't we do something like pay hazard pay to everyone from highway patrol people to animal control to stand inside of Ace Hardware or some, you know, or the grocery stores and say, hey, it's a $25 fine if you don't wear a mask? Voluntarily doing the right thing has not worked. What can we do?
Do you want to take that, Rachel, or I'm happy to answer it too, but I think it'd be good to start with you.
Sure. So, well, I guess I first want to say that, you know, I think most people are doing the right thing, and I am actually quite proud of Coloradans for stepping up and following public health recommendations, and in the case of masks, actually requirements. You know, we know that we all are in this together. We all need to be taking steps to protect ourselves, protect our families, protect our communities. And I agree with you that it is frustrating when we see individuals who are not, you know, following those recommendations. You know, I'd say in general, in public health, we don't have a clear sort of enforcement arm to public health, really. I mean, most of what we do is through public health recommendations. We can issue orders. There are opportunities at times to work with law enforcement, but in general, that's not historically how public health has operated. And Senator, I'd love for you to share your thoughts as well.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I definitely appreciate the spirit of the question. I've been in Salida several times over the last few months, staying at the Palace Hotel and meeting with the county commissioners and doing some other stuff up there, always wearing a mask. And I know what you're talking about. I mean, you know, in communities like Salida, Durango is another example where you get a lot of people from other places. You know, my sense is very much when I'm in these places that the locals are wearing masks and that often people from other states have not been. I hope that's been getting better, but it's the reason why, you know, the governor has taken the action that he did. And in my case, you know, I've tried very hard not to make these masks political. In fact, I and Senator Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, were the first senators to call for the CDC to release recommendations for mask wearing. And shortly after we did that, they released the recommendation saying that we should wear masks. You know, I'm grateful for Senator Toomey's leadership there. To me, a mask, wearing a mask is an act of self-reliance, and it is an incredibly inexpensive way to protect yourself, protect the community, but also do what you said, which is, you know, it's the best way to keep our economy open. It's the best way to make sure that our kids can stay in school. And it's one of the easiest things that we can do to protect our community. When I hear the political debate over it, people say, oh, this is an incursion on my freedom. You know, I think nobody's asking anybody to climb the, you know, the cliffs of Normandy here. We're being asked to wear a mask for a temporary period of time in order to get past this. And I think that the most important thing we can do is communicate with each other about it. I think there's some places where people have enforced it and other places where it's been less enforced. And I'm not sure from the sort of a criminal law perspective that it's made a difference in terms of public health outcomes. So we obviously have to stay on it and think about it. And I hope that the curve in Colorado will continue to move in the right direction. If it doesn't, we might have to think about something else. Thanks a lot, Dee. Connor, let's take the next one.
Yes, next we have Joe from Parker. Joe, you're now live. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you, Senator, and your staff. You are the best. And this is COVID-related. There are homeless people on the streets across the U.S., and especially sad for me are the number of vets. And here in Aurora, the problem is getting worse daily. And I was wondering how we fix the problem, because obviously that's COVID-related, too, because you have these people huddled together. They
yep.
don't know each other. So I'll leave it at that. But thank you for what you have been doing and what you will do.
Joe, thank you, and thanks for your advocacy. I can't tell you how much I appreciate. This has been a real issue for our homeless population. And as everybody on this call knows, our homelessness population has grown in urban Colorado and in rural Colorado directly as a result of this crisis. So the first thing I want to mention to anybody who's experiencing homelessness, who might be on this call or needs support, or if you know somebody who's homeless, or to make sure that they can call 211 to get support and emergency services, including housing. So please make a note about that, to talk to people that are facing this. I actually will talk to the mayor about your idea about the theater. I don't know anything about that, Joe, but I'll check in with him. The COVID and economic crisis is hurting the services that exist to support our community members experiencing homelessness, and the weather is only going to make things more difficult. We're working to pass more funding here for state and local governments, which includes housing support. And I also think the other bills that I mentioned earlier, the Restart Act and the Health Force, will help to support organizations that work to support homeless folks and get them through this crisis. I don't know, Rachel, if you want to add anything, or we can also move on. So I leave it up to you.
Yeah, no, just a recognition, I would say, that obviously homelessness is a huge public health crisis. And, you know, as a physician, I recognize that, you know, we need to first meet people's basic needs before we can really put efforts in place to improve their health. And so I think that there's obviously significant challenges, and the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, has revealed, I think, and created, I think, worse disparities than existed before the pandemic. And we see that obviously playing out with homelessness, but also I think playing out with other health disparities that exist with our communities of color and other communities where these disparities have been longstanding and I think unfortunately made worse by this pandemic.
I tell you, and another place we've seen the disparities that existed before and have gotten a lot worse is in the educational world, too. Having been the superintendent of Denver Public Schools, I spent a lot of time talking with teachers and principals and families across the state, and I don't think a single call that I've had about education hasn't ended in tears because of people's frustration about kids falling behind and the incredible gap that exists, all the more reason why we should be following the public health guidelines to try to accelerate our time out of this crisis. Connor?
Next, we have Jeff from Longmont. Jeff, you're now live. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Good morning, Senator. I am night manager at a family-owned restaurant. We have been devastated by the pandemic. Much of our staff are struggling on unemployment. Those that are still working are not making enough money to get by. We have a limited demand for to-go, and parking lot dining just isn't doing it.
Yeah.
What are your plans to help my employer, my coworker, and me to survive through this pandemic?
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it, and I hope you'll pass along my regards to your employer. Even before COVID hit, I've been working on unemployment benefits reform to ensure that benefits replaced a greater share of wages and that they last as long as they were needed when the unemployment rate rises. So that's even before COVID. And the reason for that is that I think we should never be in a situation where the benefit cliffs I mentioned earlier are happening. You know, we have people who are facing a cut of a half to two-thirds of their benefit in August and are now face losing them entirely at the end of the year if we don't do something. And as you said, that's why those benefits seem insufficient, and they are insufficient. What you just said is true. And by the way, it's not just that it helps the people that are on unemployment, although that is the most important thing. It also has helped our economy in Colorado stay alive on life support. I mean, it's meant $4 billion of investment in our economy that we would not have had if it had not been in place. So I have been pushing to extend unemployment benefits to be long enough to last to the other side of the vaccine, because there are people who literally can't work, neither because of the risk to themselves or because their jobs aren't available or because they're a restaurant, like the one where you work, Jeff, where you can't put enough tables outside, and certainly not during the winter, to make it work. And the benefits need to be generous enough to help people pay the bills. This is one of the worst economic downturns that we've had since the Great Depression. And we can have a discussion, a vigorous debate about how good or poor the national response has been on this thing. But it certainly isn't the fault of small businesses in Colorado or the people that have worked for them. I, alongside of what I've tried to do on unemployment, I've been pushing for targeted food assistance and rental assistance to prevent really deep hardship and among the hardest hit workers and families. I mean, there are a lot of families going hungry if we don't do what we need to do. And on restaurants in particular, you know, as you know, they've had to operate at a lower capacity right now. The economies reliant on tourism, like Dee talked about in Salida, are not able to be fully staffed, and certain workers, like people in live music or theater, have essentially no opportunities to work at all. Any business that requires a crowd to be a business is going to be very depressed until the vaccine is widely deployed. So that's why I wrote what's called the Restart Act with Senator Young, and that's the one with 59 co-sponsors. That would give small businesses in this country, the hardest hit small businesses, the chance to access working capital loans and to have those most of those loans forgiven based on how hard hit their business has been, just like the restaurant you're talking about in Longmont. All of this is just a reminder of the ability for us to get something done. This is not rocket science. It's common sense, and it's why we need the Senate to do better, and frankly, why we need Mitch McConnell to get out of the way and let us legislate what we can legislate. Connor?
Next, we have Jennifer from Centennial. Jennifer, you're now live. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. I'm a small business owner in Centennial. I own a restaurant, so this is a good follow-up after the.
Do you mind telling us the name of your restaurant, just in case people want to?
Yeah, it's called Roro Juice. R-O-R-O Juice. Mm-hmm. We're an all-organic juice bar and cafe in Centennial, Colorado. So we took advantage of some of the CARES Act, both the PPP and the EIDL. So my last meeting with our accountant, we found out that the loan forgiveness is only going to apply for one of the programs. So because we took money for the PPP to keep an employee on staff, we also received the emergency EIDL, and we're a small business. We only had three employees at the time. So we're talking about a $3,000 advance for the EIDL that I just found out is now going to be turned into a loan rather than a forgivable program like the PPP is. And we do qualify for complete forgiveness with the PPP, which is great.
Yeah.
However, there wasn't really like any distinction when we were doing all that paperwork saying that the emergency EIDL, if you chose to take advantage of the PPP, would not be forgivable. Now, I did understand that, you know, if we chose to take, you know, a true loan through the EIDL, that that would be a loan at a specific rate. So I was wondering if there's anything in your Restart Act that's going to address that and potentially make both the PPP and the emergency EIDL forgivable.
Yeah, you know, Jennifer, thank you so much. I've heard a ton about this from small business owners across the state who were not provided with clarity about how the two programs interact. And then a decision was made that basically reversed one of the grants. That's the effect of what the government has done. The intent of Congress was for the EIDL or EIDL grant and for PPP both to be forgivable to the extent that businesses use the funds appropriately, as you mentioned. There was not a distinction made by Congress, and I think this is something, this change has to be in the mix to be addressed in the bipartisan package that we're working on right now. I'm extremely supportive of that change being made. I think that and I think that others are hearing from small business owners across the country in their states. And you didn't ask about this, but I know the deductibility of PPP expenses has also been an issue that's been raised, and I'm hoping we can address that so that PPP expenses are deductible, which was the intent of Congress. So that's where we'd like to fix the problem that you're talking about. With respect to Restart, those loans would be in addition to PPP, and they would be deductible, and forgiveness would not be reduced based on people having been in the other programs. Because, again, this is all about bridging a gap. This is not about small businesses that are misappropriating money. This is about bridging a gap to keep people afloat so that when we get out of this pandemic, which I know we will, we've saved places like Jennifer, that you've been able to save your business, or the restaurant in Longmont that called before. So let's stay in touch on it. And if anybody, by the way, has issues like this, please feel free. I'm going to give the phone number of my office at the end of the call. Feel free to call us. We've got a bunch of people on staff that are working on this stuff 24 hours a day.
Next, we have a question from Alan. We also have a question from online from Dwayne Watson that is similar, that I will intro and then turn it over to Alan. Dwayne asks, testing, tracing, and treatment is the only way we can isolate and control this virus. Taiwan has done this with remarkable success. When can we get started? Rapid paper test strips can do this cheaply and be done at home 2 to 3 times per week. Alan, you are now live. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, thank you, Senator Bennett. Thank you and your staff for your incredible service. And I've had the fortune to work with your staff closely, as you know, as a leader of one of our R1 institutions in Fort Collins. And Dr. Hurley, in the same way, I've worked with your staff as well. And so picking up on the testing and tracing, I'd like to focus it in particular on the education ecosystem, because I think the Biden administration is certainly going to focus on getting our schools open, because of the significant cost to our young people in this pandemic, both in terms of mental health and then their ability to compete. And as the person online suggested, you know, testing and contact tracing is one of those areas that is one of the parts of the Swiss cheese model to getting us back into some equilibrium. Yet testing the population on a college campus and in our schools K through 12 presents unique challenges, both because many are asymptomatic and then many of the tests are not approved by the FDA for under 18 or have special considerations in testing that population. I'm curious, Senator, on the federal level, what's the focus of some opportunities to actually focus resources in this area? And then on the contact tracing side, I think there are some tools that are available the state's already been using to digitally enhance, such as opt-in programs or ECMO, to look at movements of people and even kids who a lot of which carry cell phones. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are and opportunities to focus on the educational ecosystem, both in terms of testing and contact tracing. And to the point on the internet, I think this is a key not just for the educational system, but for small businesses and our general population as well.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for your leadership as VP of Research at CSU. You've been doing really important work during all this. I'm going to let Rachel or Dr. Herlihy answer that question first, and then I'm happy to give you a flavor of what's happened at the federal level.
Yes, thank you for the question. I think both Dwayne and Alan bring up lots of really good questions and good points there. So, you know, you've heard me say multiple times already during this call that we still have so many questions remaining about this virus. And, you know, support for our research institutions in Colorado and across the country are really critical to make sure that we continue to have evolving science delivered to us around this virus. We know what the best treatments are. We see vaccine advancements. We know and we have better testing modalities that are available for use, and we know which populations they can be used on. I think all of those are really critical parts of the strategy to control this virus. And I absolutely agree with you that we need to continue to make sure that supports are in place to advance all of that technology, whether it's testing, whether it's treatment, whether it's vaccines, or whether it's, you know, contact tracing tools or the data science that we need to understand how transmission is happening. So all of those things, I completely agree with you, are absolutely priorities. And then also completely agree that our educational environment needs to be a priority. And, you know, we are working on improving our guidelines from public health on school environments, how to best use quarantine strategies to minimally disrupt education when needed, how to use testing and increase the availability of testing, which scenarios are best to prioritize testing for, which testing modalities can be used in those populations, what's better for students versus teachers, symptomatic versus asymptomatic. All of those things are things that we're wrestling with and trying to figure out some recommendations for Colorado schools. I think we share the same goal of seeing our schools open and seeing in-person learning happening in this state in this next semester.
Alan, I think that all summer long we saw this sort of false choice, as Rachel is saying, of do we open or do we protect public health? And I think the answer is we need to do both. And in order to do that, we need to have a robust public health infrastructure, I think more robust than the one that we have in place right now. By the way, our public health people, I think, in Colorado have been doing an extraordinary job under incredibly difficult circumstances. They've taken an awful lot of incoming for what they're doing, but what they're telling us to do makes sense. We do need more federal funding for this, and there were tens of billions of dollars included in the House bill for testing, for contact tracing, for vaccinations, and we need to find a way to get that done in the Senate version as well, because the states aren't prepared to do this themselves. I just heard yesterday we had a big meeting with a whole bunch of senators and the governor of New Jersey, the governor of Oregon, and they were and by the way, Jared Polis was supposed to be on that call. He had been invited to be on it, but couldn't be on it because he has COVID. Although now he's doing much better, but what they were talking about was how limited the resources are they have to actually deploy the vaccine. That problem exists all over the country with respect to testing and vaccinations, and that's why we need to get this bill passed. Connor, is there another question?
Yes. Next, we have Alex from Denver. Alex, you're now live. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, yeah. I'm a Denver Public Schools teacher. And
Where do you teach, Alex?
I teach at Bryan Webster in Northwest Denver.
Yep. So, thank you.
Yeah,
and what,
yeah.
What do you teach?
Yeah. I teach fourth grade in Spanish.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just, you know, I've been really concerned with how the Democratic caucus has been responding to the events that have passed since the results of the election were finalized. You know, I think the only way to really describe it is intentional sabotage of our democracy and intentional sabotage of our economy. And I guess what I'm really wondering is, at what point do we stop hearing about how it's just Mitch McConnell when we have over 200 elected Republicans who are refusing to acknowledge that Biden is the president-elect? And we have over 106 House members and 18 state attorneys general who are just asking to disenfranchise millions of voters in other states because they don't like the results of the election. I feel like we're kind of trapping ourselves into this illusion of bipartisanship that somehow this bill will get passed when a lot of Republicans aren't looking to rescue state and local governments. They actually want to repeat the crises of employments and mass public sector layoffs of 2009, and they're hoping that suppressed economy will put them back in power in 2022. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what point do Democrats like yourself start to respond and start to paint the picture of what's happening in terms of the obstruction for an economic package that'll help us get through, that'll provide the necessary infrastructure for vaccines, and also that will address the direct attack on our democracy that's happening right now?
Well, thanks, Alex. Let me just say, first of all, thanks again for teaching. It's a beautiful school where you work. I used to can remember when I was superintendent starting the school year a couple times at Bryant Webster, so I'm grateful that you're there. I actually stand by what I said about McConnell earlier, because he is the only person in Washington who can decide what gets to the Senate floor and what doesn't get to the Senate floor, and he's abusing his power. And in my mind, that doesn't, I mean, I think that's because of who he is. In my mind, that's just my opinion. On the other point, though, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, look, I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. The country's never seen anything in our lifetime. I saw Cory Gardner the other day give his farewell speech on the floor of the Senate, and he talked about how, you know, he accepted the will of the voters because that's what the peaceful transfer of power was all about. That's what everybody in Congress should be saying about Donald Trump. There are members of the delegation in our state who are supporting the Texas lawsuit that is without any foundation at all and is, you know, the sort of kind of conduct that you'd expect in a tyrannical, you know, regime or an autocratic country, not in the United States of America. So I think we need to be very clear about that, and I am extremely clear about it in the state. You know, whether I'm talking to Republicans or Democrats, Donald Trump lost this election by almost 7 million votes, and he lost the election in every one of these swings, almost every one of these swing states, by far more than he won the election against Hillary Clinton. This election, the people that ran this election and had responsibility for protecting it from foreign actors and from the Russians and from others say that it's the most secure election that we've ever had. And I'm on the Intelligence Committee, and I can tell you that that's true. In 2016, it wasn't true. 2018, we did better. This year, we did even better. So this election was run fair and square. Donald Trump lost, and he should be leaving. But everybody on this call knows he's never going to admit it. He'll always say that it was rigged. He's been saying it was rigged from the very that it would be rigged if he lost, and that's exactly what he's saying today. He is a sore loser and a pitiful loser, a pathetic loser, and the people in the Congress that are unlike Republicans in Georgia that are standing up to protect their democracy in Georgia and pushing back, you know, the Republicans in the Congress that are endorsing what the president is doing, endorsing what what the lawsuit in Texas is all about. You know, I think that's a shameful and it does risk our democracy. You know, so let me just go back to the bill, though, because the only way to pass this bill is with a bipartisan vote. There's no other way to do it. We did it in March. We got a unanimous vote out in March, and we've got to find a way to get it done now because, as you know, it's not my preference that Mitch McConnell is running the majority. I think Democrats should have actually won the majority this time. We didn't, or at least so far we haven't. Georgia might change things. That's a discussion you and I can have another day about why we didn't win. But in the meantime, what we have to do is get something passed. If we don't pass something, then we're going to have to make it clear who obstructed it and what we were trying to do. But I think over the next 10 days, we've really got to do everything we can to try to bring as many people along with us as possible. Thanks for teaching. Connor?
Yes, our last question of the morning is going to be from Joe from Boulder. For those who were screened and did not get a chance to ask your question, I know there are a number of you out there. Please know that we have recorded them and we'll have our staff follow up with you after the call. Joe from Boulder, you're now live.
Good morning, Senator, and thanks for having these town halls.
Thanks, Joe.
I want to get the climate change. I'm a retired NOAA meteorologist and fully aware that the Biden-Harris administration intends to get us back in the Paris Agreement. What do you think ought to be the priorities for both the federal level and especially here in Colorado for addressing climate change?
Well, I really appreciate it, Joe. I actually spent a great deal of the summer and fall visiting with farmers and ranchers around Colorado who are dealing with at a social distance and wearing a mask and outside in people's fields, who are dealing with the effects of extreme drought caused by climate change. And you mentioned the horrible fire season that we just had. Our Colorado had the worst fire season in our history. California had the worst fire season in their history. Oregon, Washington, we all did. Because of the change in climate and because of the failure of the federal government to invest in mitigation. And this is so important to all of us in Colorado. It's not just the communities that are affected. I mean, I was in Grand Lake while the fire was going on there, and it was just terrible to see what was happening. But you need to understand that it's not just them, it's everybody, because the headwaters of our water supply in Colorado are in those national forests and in those high elevations in our country, so in our state. So first, I believe we need to take immediate action to craft a climate and clean energy agenda that's going to put us on track to achieve net zero emissions by 50/50. And the issues we're seeing on the ground are only going to get worse if we don't get a handle on the cause, and that's what we need to do. Second, I think we need to invest in the health of our forests, as I said, our watersheds, our soils. They represent critical infrastructure just the way, in the same way as our roads and bridges, and we need them to be healthy and resilient to climate change. By the way, if we do that, and I'm having a lot of conversations with senators across the West and in other places, we would create a lot of high-paying jobs in rural parts of Colorado that are really desperately needed. Third, we got to work with communities transitioning from fossil fuels to create new high-quality job and economic growth opportunities, and that can't be an afterthought. I think it's got to be central to what we do. And finally, we've got to invest in American leadership on researching and manufacturing the next generation of technologies to help us mitigate climate change and respond to the changes we're already seeing on the ground. We have a choice to make. You mentioned the Paris Agreement, and that choice is, do we want to be a leader or a follower on climate? And I believe if the United States is a leader on climate change, that provides us the best opportunity that we have to create an economy that's actually working for everybody in the country, not just the people at the very top. For 50 years, The top 10% of the American people have done pretty well, but 90% of the American people have not seen a pay raise. The gulf between rich and poor has grown. The gulf between urban and rural has grown. The gulf between people of color and other Americans have grown. And I think that the kind of investment that would result in our making the transition to a clean energy economy is one that's going to produce a ton of jobs and a lot of income across the state of Colorado and across the country. So thanks for that question. I think we're probably at the end, Connor. Is that right? I'm sorry about that because I really enjoyed the time we've been together.
Yes, that's correct, unfortunately.
Why don't Rachel Herlihy, Dr. Herlihy, let me turn it back over to you to see if you've got some final thoughts about where we are, and then I'll say goodbye and we'll be done.
Oh, great. Thank you, Senator. Just a final thank you to everyone on the phone for participating and allowing me to share my thoughts today. Grateful to all of you for the actions you've taken to help control transmission of this virus in Colorado, and thank you for your ongoing actions, whether that's wearing masks, social distancing, limiting your gatherings, and of course, washing hands is critically important as well. So thank you for everything you're doing for supporting management of this pandemic here in Colorado.
And thank you for everything you're doing, Dr. Rachel Herlihy, for helping us manage it. It's just been an incredible pleasure to be able to do these calls with you and to know you're on top of what we need to do, and we're doing it, and we just got to keep doing it. And I get a lot of faith when I travel around the state and meet with local officials, business owners, farmers and ranchers, and others who, you know, we have a discussion. Sometimes it's a discussion where there's a disagreement about masks. Sometimes it's a discussion where there's a disagreement about the importance of this. And sometimes there's even a discussion about Donald Trump. And sometimes there's a discussion about how we're just going to be perpetually divided. I reject that. I don't think we need to be perpetually divided. I don't think masks need to be a political issue. I don't think social distancing or public health needs to be political issues. And I think that the answer to how do we get the economy back on track, how do we do the right thing on public health, are inextricably linked together, and that's what we need to do. And you know, I think if we follow the examples of Americans and Coloradans who have faced even tougher challenges than the ones we're facing right now, and the ones we're facing right now are tough, they're hard. If you've got a small business, or if you're a teacher in an elementary school, or the parent of school-aged kids, this is a tough, tough time for all of us. A homeless person, as was discussed on this call. But I think there's a moment where, when we're at our best, we pull together, support each other, and get through this. And I think there's no reason to think that Colorado won't be a leader in doing that over the next period of time until we get to the other side of this pandemic. So thank you all for being on the call. Please stay safe. Please be cautious, and especially going into these holidays. And I look forward to seeing everybody sometime soon in person. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thank you.